All right, and welcome everybody to the House of the Rising Sun. We have Bruce Rawls and Lynn Johnson here, and Cheryl is asking, can you join us tonight? So
yeah, now I will. Now that I know, thanks.
Communication—it's a cool thing.
yeah, exactly.
So morning, there's some new people in the room. I don't know if you recognize or realize. I think we talked about it last week. That we moved out of the education section of Pal Talk into the religion and spirituality section. And since we moved last week, we have lots of visitors who come in who don't know anything about us, don't know anything about A Course in Miracles, don't know anything about Awakening Together. So they're just now learning. And we've had a couple of guys in here this morning who were asking questions about the ego. Joan was reading the lesson and they were, let me see some of the things that people wrote. Of course, the guy that wrote that is not here, but he's asking, you know, I think the ego has already been defined as something and now you're redefining it. What does it mean? And what is forgiveness?
Great. Well, perfect. Because I was thinking the two things that I thought we might cover would be today's chronological workbook lesson, which is Forgiveness is the Key to Happiness, which is also the title of one of Susan Dugan's books, which is excellent, by the way. And the other one that touches on the ego very nicely is FAQ number 1127, which has a wonderful description about the war against yourself, which is really there's so many ways to define the ego because there's so many ways that we define ourselves basically that are not true. And so that's why it's a very open question. But anything that is where we're not peaceful is probably a pretty good working definition.
Exactly.
But there's wonderful descriptions in this frequently asked question. So maybe we could start with that. How's that sound?
Which one is it again?
It's 1127.
1127. Let me get it up and post it in the room.
Okay.
So that people will know where we're at. How can one hold two opposite thoughts in the mind at the same time? Oh my, what a great question.
And
read the question that the person asked in the room. Mm-hmm. And it says, I asked a question earlier and you said, wait around, which I did. What is your definition of the ego then, please? What is its nature and where is it within ourselves? So I know how to recognize it. So I think this question is going to probably tap onto that pretty easily.
Yeah. I also have a good acronym that I found helpful, and maybe this listener or other listeners will find useful too. And that's the acronym of GIST, which is GIST. And it really ties into the double shield of oblivion that's covered in about, five or six paragraphs down the page on workbook lesson 136.
That we're going to talk about tomorrow night, too.
Yeah. Thank you for that. and the GIST acronym really is so simple because it's guilt, which is the inner shield of oblivion, which is the ego's whole thought system of sin, guilt, and fear, and death, and oblivion, and the idea that somehow we destroyed perfect oneness, and we actually believe that, and because we're so terrified, and we actually think we pull it off, we try to do everything to stay out of our mind, and that's why resistance is such an important idea to address, and to be gentle with ourselves, and not fight ourselves. And then the other three letters stand for individuality, space, and time. So if any of those ideas or principles seems to be dominating our thoughts and our awareness, then we can pretty well figure that the ego is involved in some capacity. And individuality, of course, is anything that says me first, a we they paradigm, kind of a situation where we realize that we're placing our special interests above the shared interests in any situation. And then space and time cover pretty much everything else. So it's a pretty useful acronym, I find. So if I can see where I'm making the distance between my what I define as myself, my separate self, and something else as important, or a geographical difference, you know, whether it's the national, gender, political, economic, philosophical, any difference basically that involves space or time. And the time, you know, obvious ones would be age differences, you know, generational kinds of things. But it could also be the idea that we feel separate from what we might have had in the past, nostalgia, or a feeling that, you know, victimhood that keeps us from appreciating the gifts that we have in the classroom that we have in the present. And it could even be past lives or future lives. I mean, so the acronym GIST, I think, is a pretty useful one for identifying anything that has to do with the ego. So hopefully that's helpful. But why don't we read this FAQ? Unless you have something else to add first, Lynn.
You start and I'll follow.
Okay. I'm just going to give the context here. If you go to FACIM.org, which is the Foundation for A Course in Miracles.org, and you click on the resources link. Let me get the right phraseology. I'll just type it in real quick myself. FACIM.org, and so this is kind of the way to get to it. You go to Online Learning Aids in the left menu there, just because it's, you know, it takes a few clicks to get to it. But it's pretty straightforward. And then you go to question and answer, which is the first submenu. Then you'll see on that page a link that goes to facimoutreach.org for people who are new to this. And there you will see sort of a welcome page. And then it gives you, down below it says, how to use the site, topic index, list of all questions, search feature, and then some study guidelines. And if you're new to this, it's a wonderful resource. Of course, everything on the FACIM.org site is I think fabulous. I'm sort of in the Will Rogers school of Ken Wapnick, that I never met a contribution that Ken or anybody at the FACIM Foundation for A Course in Miracles made that I didn't like. And the same is true with ACIM.org, which is undergoing a transformation, and I've been working diligently on that myself, actually, and have a lot of fun with it. It's going to be an even more wonderful resource than it is already. So those two sister sites are just tremendous resources for students of A Course in Miracles. And you can find the entire workbook there, and soon the text and the manual on that site. But meanwhile, if we look at where we got to with our clicks here, if you see a list of all questions here, that'll take you to part 1 through 7, and we're going to be going into, I believe it's part 5. Let's see, where is that one? It'll give you over 1,300 questions. But you can search for them using the search feature. So I'm just going to skip to the questions that were for the 18th of April in the tab. Let me stretch out the tab. I think it's 2007. Yeah, 2007. Okay. So it is question number 1127, which I'll now read. And I'm doing that for the benefit of the folks who might be new to the forum here that want to make use of this resource, which is wonderful. It's just got so many great things in it. Also, the Lighthouse articles are there on the FACM site. And if you are the least bit interested and have studied the course for a while, or even if you haven't and just want to get an idea of what it's really trying to share with us, I highly recommend the streaming video presentations from the Foundation for A Course in Miracles that a little over a year ago they were having some technical issues that only lasted a month or two, and then they found a different system. And now that both the technical issues and the quality of what they share, just like the founder, Ken Wapnick, who had done for many years, they're continuing on and doing a wonderful job with that. And I highly recommend all those wonderful, wonderful streaming video classes and academy classes. So without further ado, I'll read question number 1127. Can you describe the process of looking at the horror and guilt in the ego with love beside you? Well, there it is in a nutshell. Without the use of personal symbols or names, how do you hold two completely antithetical thoughts in mind simultaneously? I've got to scoot my little Skype thing out of the way, in order to allow for the process of forgiveness. It seems that it's always one or the other. The emphasis on developing a, quote, personal relationship, unquote, with either Jesus or the Holy Spirit makes me wonder how this process works if those, quote, relationships, unquote, don't seem possible. What if the only figure that seems remotely plausible, and in parentheses, in terms of having a connection, is Yogananda? Well, of course, you can use any symbol you want that reminds you of the awareness we took into the dream that speaks gently and kindly of our lack of guilt and everyone's lack of guilt and the undoing of the belief in separation that A Course in Miracles represents. So do you want to read the first paragraph of the answer that's given here, Lynn? Are you still there, Lynn?
I'm still here.
Okay.
just had to unmute my mic.
So. Oh, I know how that goes. I do the same, yeah.
Okay, so here we go. And I was also looking at I Am That with Nisargadatta, because I've been in a class studying Nisargadatta.
Right.
And that's one of the, you know, obviously, the sense of I am, the sense of this being something that is separate or different from God, is the major problem.
You know,
you want to know what the problem is? It's I think I'm separate from God. You know, I want to know what the solution is to no longer think I'm separate from God. I mean,
right. And the class we have for that is everyone and everything in our lives to undo that separation through forgiving our belief in it. And that's how we can use every minor irritation to outright, you know, warfare. to look at our investment in an identity that is, by its very definition, at war with everyone and everything else, and that's what destroys our peace. I mean, it's really simple when we really get kind of our minds above the battleground of duality, but the classroom that really gets us home is the world, which is the outer shield of oblivion, which is our, to finish that thought that I was sharing a few minutes ago, that is really the perfect classroom. Every single thing that happens, seems to happen to us, is really coming from us, from our unconscious mind, but we would never know the unconscious guilt in our minds without that classroom. And I think that is the brilliance of the thought system of undoing that the Holy Spirit or the Jesus of A Course in Miracles, or what I like to call our inner kindness teacher, gives us an opportunity to look at. And by doing that without condemnation, looking at every single thing that happens to us without condemnation, we get an opportunity to undo it. And without that, we would be in deep sushi.
Exactly.
Yeah, we would be in real trouble if we didn't have that mechanism. So we can afford to actually be very grateful for everyone and everything, because they are a reminder of the contents of our mind. And if we're the slightest bit irritated, or upset to any degree, that's our opportunity to forgive our decision-making faculty and as the Course in Miracles says, choose once again.
Exactly. So the questioner was asking here is, you know, how do I look at this horror and guilt in the ego, with love beside Jesus? And the questioner is asking, they don't really relate to Jesus or the Holy Spirit.
Mm-hmm.
And so they actually, relate to Yogananda, which really makes a lot of sense to me, having been, you know, involved with the Yogananda. I can't even think now.
Self-Realization Fellowship.
Self-Realization. Yes. SRF. Uh-huh. Early on.
Yeah.
And so. anyway, so I do understand that. I do get that, but I also for Westerners, most of us really do tend to, even from our early age, having been, even exposed through other kids at school, if we didn't go to church,
mm-hmm.
that this Jesus thing was something worth following or listening to.
Yeah. Oh, and another thing that might be good to mention, too, is in the context of what you're just saying, Lynn, is that because most people in the world are exposed to English and the Western ethos, if you will. Even if we don't have any affiliations with Christianity whatsoever or Judeo-Christianity, to widen it a little bit. The whole Western paradigm is so, you know, by osmosis, really. I think we get so much of that. Even people in Asia and remote parts of the world that probably, you know, don't have a lot of context, just whatever exposure we do have with the Western world, this provides us with an opportunity to, reverse or clear up some of the misconceptions that the unconscious Christian ethic has put out. And this isn't a dig on Christianity, although it does undo and reverse a lot of the ideas of the insolubility of guilt, if you will, that Christianity puts out, whether it's a conscious or unconscious level, that suggests that the guilt in our minds that is unconscious is unfounded. And I think that's where the real hope is, and that's what gives us the opportunity to look at that horrific thought system with the love within us in our hearts. And that's how we can do it. Because if we don't have that peaceful awareness with us, then we're just gonna, you know, retreat deeper into fear. And I think that's why the Course is so emphatic about having, whether it's Yogananda, whether it's Buddha, whether it's, you know, pick your symbol. It could be any Nisargadatta, Sri Ramana Maharshi. It could be any symbol that represents someone that you admire, or it doesn't have to be a person, or just a principle that reminds you that there's a possibility, even that maybe we didn't shatter perfect oneness. Maybe there is a perfection and an innocence and a complete peace that is our true nature, that couldn't possibly have been threatened or damaged, and that's our real nature. In fact, the Course in Miracles starts out with nothing real can be threatened, nothing unreal exists, herein lies the peace of God. And that's really a very profound and terse summary of the entire philosophy.
Exactly. And I know when I read that, I immediately knew it was true.
Yeah.
The thing that really got me about the Course, I read that and I said, this is true. Because I had known, you know, for many, many, many years, having been through the path and studied, Yogananda and been through, Buddhism with, Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, mm-hmm. Those are really big, non-dualistic teachings that are significantly different than Western Christianity,
right,
and yet significantly the same as the teachings of Jesus from the Bible. So if you actually read the Bible and actually read whatever is written that apparently Jesus said, it is the same thing.
But to clarify that, I think what you're probably referring to is the esoteric teachings that somehow didn't get left on the cutting room floor when the Bible was edited numerous times. That's how I'd probably phrase it.
Well, and actually, the teachings are still there. And
they are in places.
Like Joel Goldsmith, Mary Baker Eddy, who he, you know, studied with, and Joel. If you listen to him or read his work, it is astoundingly, you know, exactly what A Course in Miracles is saying. And he got all his information from the Bible. So it just goes to show you that, you know, the Holy Spirit can use anything, even if it's been tremendously altered,
right,
to teach these lessons and to bring about this understanding and knowing. So, like I said, it's the Bible itself. It the truth is in everything.
Exactly.
You just gotta find it.
But the truth actually really is in us, and we, with that thought system, can see it in everything. And that's really what we're here to do, is to see all of spirit in everyone rather than just little bits of it. And to look at the horror, as this, FAQ suggests, of the ego's thought system in everyone and everything, but see it as having no consequence, no effect. And and basically as being a non-deal, you know, no big deal. And I think that's our challenge, because we're so invested in our egos that to do that requires incredible patience and a willingness to allow, you know, at our own rate and in our own time, that thought system to be undone. And so that requires, you know, a lot of willingness to let go of that resistance. And we each do it at our own rate. And we, exactly. and we vacillate a lot for over many years, typically.
Well, we do. And the point of willingness, actually, willingness comes from success. And
mm-hmm.
so,
yes.
you know,
yes.
when you practice something and you get a good result from it, then you are willing to continue to practicing it. And so, you know, this is what I find. These lessons are so gentle mm-hmm. and so so clear that when you actually practice them, this lesson today, which I think we're going to get into here in a little bit, really talks about how to do it. And when you do it, you will have a result. I guarantee you will have a result. So let's go ahead and read this answer.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay. To look with love at anything of the ego is simply to look without judgment or guilt or fear. It is only the ego that wants you to believe that this process involves holding two antithetical thoughts in the mind simultaneously. For to borrow the title of an audio tape set by Kenneth and Gloria Wapnick, love does not oppose. The idea is expressed in chapter 23 of the text, The War Against Yourself, which is what we were just talking about. The truth does not fight against illusions, nor do illusions fight against the truth. Illusions battle only with themselves. And then again, in the workbook, in the context of determining our function, the ego, quote, the ego does constant battle with the Holy Spirit on the fundamental question of what your function is. So does it do constant battle with the Holy Spirit about what your happiness is. It is not a two-way battle. The ego attacks and the Holy Spirit does not respond. And that's from workbook lesson number 66. So there is a war going on, and the ego is the one who's waging the war. The ego is the one that's making up the battles, making up the rules, figuring out, you know, what is allowable, what makes me guilty and what doesn't, what makes me an individual, what doesn't, what entails space and time, what doesn't. The ego is making this stuff all the time and thinking that it's, you know, causing this big ruckus. And the Holy Spirit is going to be annoyed or upset or irritated. In fact, the ego is planning that God is going to be irritated with me for doing this and is saying, you're guilty for doing it. Look at you. You're upsetting God.
God's going to get you. God's going to get you. Yeah, because that's ego's schizophrenic lowercase g God, you know, that is obviously totally fictitious if we look at it with any kind of sanity or logic, which is, of course, what the Holy Spirit or Jesus of the Course represents symbolically. But we can use any figure that, you know, represents that too, if we even want a figure. And I tend to like inner kindness teacher, because I like to think of that principle that we took with us into the dream as an abstract awareness that reminds me that my real being is this perfect, all-encompassing abstraction that is truly peaceful and truly comforting and has an innocence and awareness and a joyousness that transcends the idea of change. And that's really kind of sweet. But like the Course says, you know, a peaceful mind is not a small gift, but we're so immersed in our identity as warriors that we hardly can get that, you know, because we spend so little time in that realm typically. But anyway, it just ties into what you're saying nicely, Lynn. Yeah.
Well, yeah. And so when we look about our life and we see the things that appear to be happening to us and you know, we have a choice of either believing that the worst is yet to come and you know, I'm a terribly guilty person who deserves all this, which is a common thought. I mean, it's not just me thinking that. I mean, that is common thought amongst anyone that you talk to, when you get right down to why, what is the cause of all the trouble in your life, they're going to tell you it's because I'm awful. I'm pitiful. I'm evil. I pick the wrong man every time. I don't know how to manage my money and, you know, so I'm constantly broke. I am incompetent in my job because, you know, I'm doing something I really hate to do and I just, you know, every day go there grudgingly and wanting to kill everybody there. And yet, you know, I'm, and I feel terrible about that. I feel terrible about my thoughts. See, you believe in that these ego thoughts are your own thoughts. And if your own thoughts are that insane, you should be feel terrible. That would be the only way to be natural and normal is to be filled with guilt because of it.
Yeah, but it reminds me of the Linda Ronstadt song, "You're No Good, You're No Good." Yeah. But that's kind of like the unconscious soundtrack that is becomes our ego mantra if we don't examine the nature and the cause of those thoughts and question it and bring it, you know, consistently and perpetually into question. Not in any kind of a, you know, an anxious way, but just to gently say, hey, is this really what I want? I mean, am I really, can I choose peace instead of this? Yeah.
Exactly. And feeling guilty because I want to choose peace.
Right.
Because everybody else is suffering. Mm-hmm. And why would I, you know, why would I? And in fact, people who do choose things that they think are going to give them peace, and it's a temporary thing, it's something of the world, you know, I choose to, you know, marry this, you know, this trophy wife, or I choose to spend all my money gambling, or I choose to drink and hang out in the bar, because that makes me feel better. I feel better when I'm doing those things, and then when I'm done doing them and I'm broke or she's left me or I've lost everything I had, I'm going to feel guilty because now there's people who are depending on me who are not going to be taken care of because I chose my own comfort, whether it's a drug, whether it's a something that we do for fun, whether it's watching TV, whether eating. All these things we choose to try to make us more comfortable in the world are things that are destined to make us feel guilty. I ate all the ice cream. or I didn't get ice cream and everybody else did. Or, you know, I sacrificed my own ice cream for you. The thought system is just made to keep us in a hole.
Exactly. And anytime we use comparisons or specifics, that's another example of the I and the GIST acronym of individuality where it basically reinforces the belief in separation. And even, like you say, the gratitude that is ego based, because ego can use everything against us. And that gratitude is always temporary and comparative. And it says, oh boy, I'm so glad I didn't do like those poor bums, you know, kind of thing. Or you know, that kind of thinking. So any gratitude or appreciation that's real can't possibly be based on anything that can change. And then the beauty of that is that when we really do feel that genuine gratitude, it includes everyone and no one's left out. You know, as one of Gary Renard's book titles, you know, love has forgotten no one. And because there's no way true love could, not embrace and encompass everyone and everything.
Which is interesting. We just got the thing for the next conference, which is going to be in 2018 for A Course in Miracles, and that's going to be in San Francisco. And I think the theme of that is love makes no exceptions.
Uh-huh.
And so,
good pick.
Yeah,
good pick.
Yeah, it's a good pick. I was like, I was thrilled. I was excited and jumping around and saying, "Yay, I get to speak at a conference and talk about love makes no exceptions." Boy, is that ever my topic? So,
uh-huh.
So it's all perfect. So the ego attacks and the Holy Spirit doesn't respond. So the Holy Spirit, why doesn't the Holy Spirit respond to the ego's attacks? Just a real simple question. Why not? Because it sees no attack.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the state of mind that if you are able to actually do the things this course is asking you to do, Jesus is giving you instructions how to do this, you will begin to see yourself that there is no basis for any attack, and there is absolutely no attack going on. What is going on is really a bunch of frightened children trying to find comfort in something that will never comfort them. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, becoming frantic and insane because of it. And it's children. We're innocent. We have done nothing.
And we're so identified with those roles that we play on this high production value holographic screen of our mind that we call 3D reality, that we've forgotten that this is a movie. This is just a theatrical production of our mind, and we're the managers, as it's been said, of that theatrical production. But we've forgotten that, and it's to the ego's advantage, which is a fake advantage, to give up the responsibility for that screenwriting that it's doing 24/7, not maybe on a level we're conscious of, but we're, you know, our name's at the bottom of every page on that screenplay, and we can afford to look at that only from the perspective where everyone is innocent, everyone's off the hook. But that is such an incredibly freeing feeling when we tap into that and realize, oh, that's waiting for us all the time, 24/7, 365. We just have to, you know, be willing to suspend our judgments and our condemnations and just gently look at the horror and the guilt of the ego and see that it had no effect on what we really are. And like you say, said earlier, Lenny, it really is a process where the compensation and the results we get is both long term and immediate, because the instant we look at the ego without condemnation, we reveal that it's what we've chosen or seem to have chosen, and we release our investment in it, and it automatically gets replaced with a feeling of peace. So there's the three R's that I talked about last week: the reveal, release, and replace steps of the forgiveness. And then what's left is that peacefulness that then is also not only immediately helpful, because we're no longer troubled by the specific that we brought to that altar of the mind, but that we're also then accumulating, kind of building our spiritual muscle, if you will. And of course, in truth, we're already there, so there's nothing to build or nothing to undo. But from our perspective, there seems to be an enormous amount of undoing required. But we get to do it at a pace that we're comfortable with. And everybody's rate of doing that appears to be different. But it doesn't matter, because we're all already home, dreaming of exile. And we get to choose whatever's most comfortable that leads us out of fear most easily. And that's why this curriculum is, I think, so profound, is that it reminds us that we don't have to fight the ego. We just have to let it go by looking at it gently with our inner kindness teacher or whatever symbol we find helpful.
Exactly. And it's the looking at it. It's the looking at it that we avoid, because we think that, as Lesson 93 says, that if you looked at it, you would be just recoiling in horror, because you think mm-hmm. you are the home of evil, darkness, and sin. You think that everything that right. that is going on in your mind is so horrifying that it would just make you want to kill yourself. And so, yeah. But Jesus is saying, just look at it.
Just look.
With you. I won't let you do anything stupid. I'm going to be here to listen to you when you're falling apart, and I'm going to hold your hand, and we're going to get through this. And, you know, once we do, you're going to look back and you're going to say, is that all there is?
Yeah, and before we get back to the reading, just one more quick comment that several years ago, some friends of mine and I helped Tom and Linda Carpenter do a workshop in Ashland, Oregon, when I was living in that area. And Tom had shared a story that I thought was brilliant. He talked about this kind of inner conversation with his inner teacher, you know, which he just called teacher, so the label's not important. It's just that feeling of kindness that is all encompassing. And he was going through a little mental review of all the things in his life where he thought he'd really messed up badly. And this story, I'm going to paraphrase it, of course, but it really stuck with me. The principal, is he, after this, you know, going through this laundry list of all these awful things that he thought he had done and all these shortcomings in his life, his teacher, as he called it, he asked for a response. Well, now how do I fix all that? And it was just silence. In other words, and that the lesson that he got from that is nothing happened. You know, not one song in heaven's note was missed. Everything that we think we did that was so awful, so egregious, all of our secret sins and hidden hates and all the stuff where we thought we really messed up, you know, whether it's this lifetime or countless lifetimes, had no effect. It was like there was a gap in the recording. And in truth, nothing could have possibly damaged the perfect identity that we all share as one being. And that's why the sameness is so important, is to realize that we're all the same here. We're all in the same boat, struggling to remember that we don't have to struggle.
Exactly, exactly. And for you and me, probably at this point, and a lot of other people here, you know, we've been through this, and so we've seen the proof that this is the same over and over and over. I keep getting shown the same thing. And my resistance is, you know, getting lower by the minute because I'm seeing, oh, well, you know, it was this last time. It's going to be this next time. You know, it's always the same story. Nothing really happened. And that's why this says in the workbook lesson, the ego attacks and the Holy Spirit does not respond because there's nothing to respond to, nothing. So the next paragraph says, this is the key to the process of undoing the ego in all its horror and guilt, recognizing that there is nothing that needs to be opposed nor overcome. For to fight the ego gives it a reality that it does not have. It does not deserve it. It doesn't have it. It doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. Like Don Quixote tilting at windmills. Perhaps you meant to say mutually exclusive rather than antithetical thoughts. So he's referring back to the question, saying that the thoughts that you have, either I believe that God is or I believe God isn't. You know, basically is what it is. Either I believe that I'm holy or I believe that I'm evil. You can't hold both those thoughts in your mind at the same time.
Right.
So they're mutually exclusive. And therein lies the answer. For love is our reality, and the ego, despite all the complicated forms it seems to manifest, is simply the thought that love is absent from our experience. What we made was made without love.
Right.
That's the bottom line. That's the only thing that's wrong with the illusion. If you look at the illusion and you say, well, you know, what's wrong with all this? Nothing. Well, no, the only thing that's wrong with it was made without love.
Right.
And therefore, it is destined to die. Death is the only thing that is possible. It's the inevitable result of living with a lack of love.
Or to maybe put it in a way that even lets us off the hook further, of living in a dream, which is not even real life. It was never born, and so it can never die. So, but the ego, because we think it was made up, we have to unmake it. We have to do the due diligence and follow the spiritual best practices, if you will, of looking at it gently in order to see that there was nothing there. And there's one phrase, and I think it's the Gospel of John, that I remember when I studied the Bible a little bit years ago, certainly no scholar. There was one place that I thought a symbolic quote got, you know, didn't get cut out of the editing process, and that was, the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness comprehends it not. And the light, of course, being symbolically the Holy Spirit or Yogananda in this questioner's case, you know, whatever symbol represents an awareness that we don't have to suffer, that it's needless for us to be miserable because, in truth, the false identity never happened. And because of that, there's no need to put ourselves through any more misery than necessary, and it really seems necessary because we think it takes time. We think that it's going to, you know, be a long drawn out process. But we can essentially use the supersonic transport, if you will, metaphorically, by just looking at the unconscious guilt with our inner kindness teacher, and that takes, you know, lifetimes out of the process. I mean, it shortens it by, like as the Course says, you know, in so many places, by, you know, an amount that we can't even imagine, because we're really at already at home, you know, dreaming of exile and dreaming that we somehow messed up so badly that it's irreparable. And I love what Ken Wapnick says, is, you know, that that whole thought system is not sinful, guilty, evil, or wicked. It's just silly. And we only see that from above the battleground of duality. I think that last paragraph really tells it very nicely. It's you know, it says, you know, it's not a two-way battle. It's the ego attacks and the Holy Spirit does not respond, because the response of trying to attack is there's nothing to attack. So if our ego never existed, all we have to really do is look at it honestly and objectively and see that it was made up. It's just pixels on a screen that we've chosen to interpret in a way that we've made fearful. It happens to be a three-dimensional, very high production value screen that we call 3D reality, but it's a screen. It's image making. It's just fantasy projected outwards on a scale so vast and so believable that we've all bought into it. It's just a Matrix movie.
Exactly. And what really helps me, and may not help a lot of other people, but it really helps me, is to bring it back to the fact that it's my own thought.
Yeah.
And recognizing, you know, you can do exercises, which we've done plenty of, and where you actually work back to, you know, where is this really happening? And you recognize it is happening only in my own mind. It is my own thought that is making this world. And I can make many other worlds. I can close my eyes and make a world where I'm living where Avatar was. Or I could close my eyes and make up a world where I'm living underground. Mm-hmm. I can make up all kinds of worlds. And I can actually have the experience of living it. That's what happens when we sleep and dream. It's pointing out to the fact that that's what's happening right now.
Yeah.
I'm actually living out. You and I are talking during my imaginary story. And what are we doing? We're doing what you just said from John, shining the light. There's a light shining in the darkness. And the darkness can't overcome it. It's impossible because, as everyone knows, when you walk into a dark room and you turn on the light, the light overcomes the darkness and there is no darkness left.
Mm-hmm.
And the only place where there might be darkness is where there's a shadow. There's something that's blocking the light. And so you see that the whole time, the only thing that's been happening is the light has been being blocked. So, and it can no longer do that when you let this go.
Exactly.
So the ego has no power. It has no reality, just like the darkness. And so that it's so hard to understand that because it seems so powerful. But the reason the ego, to me, this is my own thinking, the reason the ego seems so powerful is because it is my own thinking. It's the thoughts that are in my mind. And I am taking credit for those thoughts belonging to me. Even though you have the same thought and Ken has the same thought and Jim has the same thought and all these other people are having the same thought, it's my thought. So if the thought of, you know, we should, you know, go over there and destroy ISIS is in my mind, it's also in your mind and in other people's mind, not necessarily as, you know, bold as that, but it's still a thought. It's not my thought. This is not my thought. This is not God's thought. God has no intention of destroying anything because God doesn't even know it exists. And so to know, to really see, this to me is the crux of either living in the illusion and believing in the illusion. You cannot believe it halfway. You cannot believe your thoughts even a little bit. You because a miss is as good as a mile when it comes to the thought that I choose to believe.
And to bring it back to the, you know, the practical is every time that we do notice we're investing in our own unique, special thinking, there's a discomfort associated with that. And that's the foolproof mechanism to tell us when we're investing in the ego thought system is if we're not at peace.
Yeah.
If there's the least little bit of discomfort or outright terror, we can just remember that, you know, to paraphrase Simon and Garfunkel, something tells me it's all happening in the mind.
Yes.
You know, and that's the only place we're going to be able to do anything about it is back in our mind. And that's why the ego's inner shield of oblivion of, you know, looking at the mind is the last thing that it wants to do. So it made up an incredibly compelling universe of space and time and matter and energy and people and stuff and galaxies and quarks and quasars and everything in between.
Yeah, you choose to make them up. However, see, and we look at this and we say, well, yeah, but it's the reality that these things exist. These things are real. These things are, again, a product of the mind. They're a product of my thinking. You do not know, nor do I, nor does anybody else know for sure that any of those things exist.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
All we know is that we have indirect evidence, and even the visually seeing it is indirect evidence.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It is a interpretation in my mind of what of pixels or photons that mm-hmm. are being sent into my eye, turned upside down, and translated to my brain, into a place where you can actually stimulate the same place with an electrode, and you're going to see something different.
Great point. Great point, Lynn. Yeah, very cool. Yeah, that's a good reminder that everything here is just, you know, interpretation of data that is so partial and so so flawed because of its partiality, pun intended in, you know, both senses of that word. It's partial in that it's biased, and it's all partial in that it is incomplete. And so all of our sensory data, you know, even though we get, you know, trillions of sensory impressions, you know, every minute, through all our senses and super senses, you know, they're all basically just hired henchmen from an insane thought system for the most part that was contrived to bring us an experience that reinforces, you know, in a foolproof thought system. But as the Course says, it may be foolproof, for the self that we think we are. But that's not who we are, and the self that we really are, which is the one being that has that abstract love as its essential nature, knows better, and that's why we're drawn to this sort of self inquiry and to look at that identity and say, hey, maybe that's not working so well for me. Right. Maybe there must be a better way. As Helen Bill said.
And you know that it's here's a good way to know that is not true is that. It changes.
Yes.
All the time.
Bingo. Bingo.
It changes all the time.
Yeah.
Even my perception of myself, you know, I can be thinking of myself, I'm the greatest, I'm so sweet and wonderful and kind. And then the next moment, you know, I forgot to pay the light bill and the electricity shut off. And all of a sudden I'm like, oh, I'm so stupid. You know, I'm just insane. Why, what happened? You know, it changes innate like that.
Yeah, did that Genghis Khan part of my identity come from?
But you don't question it. You don't,
right.
You know, well, you know, that. How can it be that I'm at one moment I'm a holy being and the next moment I'm a dumb shit? You know, how can that be? You know, and you don't question it. You just take it for granted that that's the way it is because that's your experience. And the reason it's your experience is because that's the experience you want. It's the experience that holds our hooks into the world. And
exactly.
It's the experience that makes this whole illusion continue on and on and on in our minds is that we are getting stimulation from it that makes it appear to be real, makes it appear to be real. And I don't know, have you ever seen this movie? I don't know if we've talked about this movie, Dark City.
Yes, I have. Yes, okay. Yeah. A film noir example of ego on steroids, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And so in Dark City, none of those people knew that their lives were being changed And if those who don't know the movie, it's some kind of an alien thing, and these people are on a planet where during the night when they're sleeping, and they're put to sleep, during the night when they're sleeping, the aliens change their life.
Uh-huh.
So maybe one day, like today, I'm here talking to Bruce, and then tonight I go to sleep and the alien comes in and changes something in my mind and changes my circumstance. So that now I am the president of the United States. And so in the morning I wake up and that's who I am.
And we believe it.
And I believe it, and I live my life that way. And the aliens are trying to figure out, you know, what kind of beings are we really that we shift around like that, that we can be shifted so easily from one thing to another. But that's what it's like here, is that it's not as, you know, dramatic as some alien doing it, because I'm doing it to myself. But when the circumstance changes, like all of a sudden the circumstance is, you know, I'm, you know, sitting in a bar having a few beers with somebody and we're joking and laughing and, you know, saying, you know, crude, lewd jokes. And, you know, that's, you know, I'm having a great time. And then the next day I'm in church, being pious and noble, and forget about all that lewd, crude stuff, because that is not me. I'm a different person now. The ego is so capable of shifting from this to this to this to this. And yet we can't live with that dichotomy. You can't be at peace when you are two different things. And it's not two different things. We're thousands of different things. Because, you know, whatever I am to you is how I am to you. And, you know, I act different to you than I do to my husband. I can guarantee you that. And... And yet, excuse me, I'm still the same person.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great example. And that movie in particular is, you know, like you were saying, it's sort of a film noir version of the Truman Show kind of thing. But yeah, it brings up some good points, is that we think that there's this alien presence that's running the show. Well, that's because we've invested in the ego, which really is alien. It is this kind of macabre, bizarre, truly unbelievable identity that we've chosen to believe in, and because it's really you know, only choosing between dream options, illusion A, which really equals illusion B, which really equals illusion C, and those different identities that we take on in different roles are in, and sometimes from moment to moment, let alone lifetime to lifetime or anything in between, they're all made up. It's only when we get metaphorically above the battlefield of duality by practicing forgiveness that we start to see that all those illusions are the same. In chapter 31, that, you know, the real alternative, there's a section called that describes how, you know, perhaps you'd like to go down every single option in the dream, you know, I'm paraphrasing again, but that's the ego strategy, is to, you know, keep making metal more attractive, you know, to, with a nod to Shakespeare, to keep us forever looking for something that's better. The grass is greener, you know, cliche that always says, oh, well, there's something else that I haven't tried in the dream. There's some health regimen or some new relationship or some new job or car or house or, you know, something in the world, is whether it's a combination of people, places or things or, you know, bodily, whatever. It's always something seemingly outward that is going to do it for us, and we just try this one more thing, you know, then by God that's going to work, but it's always a come on. It's always just a seduction from a thought system that has no reality. And we know, just like Charlie Brown running up to kick Lucy's football every year, that, you know, it's going to get pulled away from us, and that we keep doing it. And so the idea is to forgive ourselves, just say, oh, there I go again. And not condemn yourself, just say, I'm running up for Lucy's football again, but I don't have to be upset when I fall for that ruse and that hoax, and just say, oh, I can afford to gently forgive myself and do it much more quickly, rather than being upset for weeks or months or days. Just, you know, begin to shorten the time to maybe just a few hours, and then maybe just a few minutes. And then eventually, you know, catch ourselves, you know, mid thought and say, no. And then we don't kick the metaphoric football. You just say, I'll choose a different road altogether. Kind of like in Groundhog Day when Bill Murray towards the end of the movie finally realizes he's stepped in the puddle on next to the curb enough times. He says, you know, I think I'll just avoid it altogether.
Exactly. Yeah. And even though it's not even necessary to avoid the puddle,
right?
You don't care about what happens.
Yeah.
If every experience, and this has been my experience, is that when I'm thinking with the Holy Spirit or when I'm thinking in my right mind, it doesn't matter what the experience is in the world. It's just the same. Yeah. And it's just as good. It is as much fun to step into that puddle as it is to walk around it. It is as much fun to, you know, eat the, drink the sour milk, you know, blah, you know, you like, what is that? Have you ever imagined, you know, having something that would in normal terms been unpleasant and just looking at it from a different direction and recognizing that, that it's the same, it's all the same kind of experience. I'm here to experience it. And so let me not reject the experience. Let me investigate the experience and see why it is that it's holding me here. Why it is that I'm so interested in I'll go on with the sour milk example. Have you ever done that? Picked up milk that you thought was good and take a swig of it and recognize that it's not.
Yeah, it doesn't suggest that we drink the whole carton. It just says, you know, if you've already swallowed some, don't make a big deal about it, and then you will be reminded to be mindful and perhaps make a better choice. And it doesn't mean you're never going to take a sour swig again. It just means that you'll be able to let go of the self-condemnation in the mind and that guilty thought, sinful, fearful thought system, which is just silly, as Ken points out, is just a dysfunctional approach to how we live our lives, and it allows us to let go of expectations that the world is going to do it for us, so that when things that our ego doesn't like, you know, come up, we don't fly off the handle, but we just say, oh, there's another feedback opportunity for me to look at my mind again and see that I always have an opportunity to make a different choice in terms of how I'm thinking and feeling. Yeah,
exactly. And I could be using that sour milk to make yogurt.
Or, yeah.
Not, you know, some people do things with sour cream, sour milk, you know.
Yeah, make lemonade.
Make lemonade.
With the lemons. Yep.
All right.
Should we zip through the rest of the paragraphs?
Zip through the rest of the paragraphs, yeah.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Oh, so let's see. Did we finish the second one?
Yeah, we finished the second one.
Okay.
So we're on, and then it is really...
Okay, and that is really the only obstacle to releasing the ego thought system. For while we remain invested in maintaining the false individual identity that we have given birth to, in union with the ego, we are making a choice to maintain a belief in the horror and guilt that must accompany this thought system as well. So it's a, you know, it's a package deal. You know, if we want individuality, we get the horrific thought system that's behind it, but we don't have to. I mean, that's the choice that it's asking us to look at. And so the process of looking without judgment is not something we can do easily, quote, on our own, unquote, since, quote, on our own, unquote, is another way of describing the ego state of mind. That's what's got us into trouble in the first place, is we want to be like John Wayne. I'll do it myself, you know. And yet that's, you know, where we got into the mess that we think we are. But it's not really a mess. It's just a dream. But we don't look at that and get out of it without what seems to be external help. But we're really calling together in our mind the attributes and the qualities and the integrity and the loving kindness that we never left. We're basically saying, I invoke that truth, that I choose that awareness of that identity that I never left, that includes everyone in my heart, that includes a complete acceptance of the reality of who and what everyone really is. And it's really not even a who, it's just the what. Okay. And then the next paragraph goes on. The value in joining with a personal symbol of love is that it provides a gentle correction for the ego belief that we are really alone and on our own, and our experience of the loneliness and pain of separation. And while we believe that our identity is a personal one, it is especially helpful to have a source of support and correction that we experience as personal as well. The mistake would be to assert that symbol of love is not real while still believing that we are real. The personal symbol is just as real as the self we believe we are. And so, again, they're all placeholders. I mean, our ultimate reality is beyond any kind of symbols or personalization. But while we think we're here, it can be very helpful. And in fact, the Course encourages us to use those training wheels until we are at a point where we don't need them.
Exactly. And that's why Jesus identifies himself as Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
Even though the personal person of Jesus is just as unreal as the personal person of Lynn.
Right.
It's not a personal character that is, you know, that lived a life and died and was resurrected and all that stuff. Excuse me. Those are the symbols, the stories that are given to us as the training wheels.
Mm-hmm.
And so once you recognize, which I think as you go along in the course, you actually come to recognize that Jesus and I are the same being. We are the same thing. And this course is my own mind, and you and I are the same. And you know, when I look at you, I see the reality of what we are. You know, that's the whole point of all of this, is to, extend that, helper role into everything and to generalize it into everything. And for me, the Holy Spirit, Jesus is a great symbol, but I still see Jesus very much as a person. And therefore, it's difficult for me to get over that and generalize Jesus as being in everything.
Mm-hmm.
But the Holy Spirit now I can see because I don't have a body association to it in my mind. So I can see that it is in and behind and around and above and beyond. It's everywhere and in everything.
Mm-hmm.
And that its personal message to me is, you know, I put some love here for you. There's a miracle behind this. And so, you know, now all you have to do is go in there and look at, you know, ask the Holy Spirit, where's the miracle here? And that's been helpful to me. It's all symbolic. It's all made
right.
up. None of those things are real,
mm-hmm.
but it's an unreal being who's talking to an unreal being, because it is really my ego. It's not who I really am who's asking these questions. Who I am knows the answers to these questions. Who doesn't know the answers to these questions is this ego person who I think I am.
Right.
And so it's
right.
ego person, the fictional ego person talking to the fictional Holy Spirit person, because the Holy Spirit even isn't real.
Right, right.
But the beauty of
this curriculum is that, as it points out, forgiveness and the symbols that we ascribe to it as our guides through the process are fictitious, but with one important difference. They are symbols that lead us out of the dream rather than deeper into it. And I think that's the crucial difference. And that's why, yeah, it's a training wheel, but it's going to be abandoned when we take the final step to total awareness of perfect oneness. But, you know, for most of us, it's probably not on our calendar for next week, you know. So, so we can afford to be patient with ourselves and use those symbols, to the benefit of everyone and the detriment of no one, and find great solace and great comfort in that true peace from every time that we let go of a dysfunctional thought that isn't serving us. And that's really what we're doing when we're looking at the horror and the desolation of ego's insane strategy to try to divide and conquer, and say that's not working for me anymore, and it never did, and just be willing to be shown another alternative, a real alternative.
Exactly. So let's see, where are we at?
I think it's just now. What name?
Okay, I'll read.
Mm-hmm.
So now, what name that personal symbol is given in our mind is not nearly so critical as that we allow ourselves to be open to a help that comes from outside our own self-centered thought system. Now, he didn't say it comes from outside of ourself. says comes from our own self-centered thought system. So if Yogananda works better for you than Jesus, by all means, seek his loving presence and support in looking at the false beliefs you hold about yourself. And I think that has more to do with your culture and mm-hmm. what you're used to. You know, if you're used to talking to Jesus, don't go, you know, saying, well, maybe I'll talk to Yogananda about this. Because unless you have a personal relationship, with Yogananda in your mind, then it, you're, it's like telling a stranger, whose power you don't know or understand. Unless you do, unless that is your symbol. So, you know, whomever it is that you believe is going to help you. So as Jesus says near the end of A Course in Miracles in reference to himself, is he God's only helper? No, indeed. For Christ takes many forms with different names until their oneness can be recognized. So that's what I just said. But Jesus is for you the bearer of Christ's single message of the love of God. You need no other. He was speaking to Helen and Bill in particular here, and that's what I was just thinking. It is possible to read his words and benefit from them without accepting him into your life. Yet he would help you yet a little more if you will share your pains and joys with him. Share your pains and joys with him and leave them both to find the peace of God. Yet still it is his lesson most of all that have he would have you learn, and it is this. And this is it. There is no death because the Son of God is like his Father. Nothing you can do can change eternal love. Forget your dreams of sin and guilt and come with me instead to share the resurrection of God's Son and bring with you all those whom he has sent to you to care for as I care for you. And that's from the clarification of terms. And this is pretty profound. We could spend an hour just talking about this last thing.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Easily. And it really is a good summary of what we've been talking about for the last, you know, hour and 10 minutes roughly. And that, you know, we're really able to forget our dreams of sin and guilt and fear by using that simple, which is, you know, it's kind of like in another book that I really found helpful years ago was The Life and Teachings of the Masters of the Far East. And okay. I remember one of the phrases in there was that it was talking about a staircase. And it was saying something to the effect, and this is from memory from decades ago now, it was talking about how when you climb a staircase, you don't pick up each stair and put it on your back. You leave it for the next person, you know? And I think, and not taking our forgiveness classroom basically is really for everyone, and that's why, you know, and I think symbolically this is showing us that minds are joined, and that we when we learn something, everyone learns it, and when we every time we choose our inner kindness teacher, that choice touches all minds because all minds are one, and ideas don't leave their source, and you know, when we reach the threshold of that perfect oneness by practicing this forgiveness classroom, We have done it for everyone and discover that, you know, everyone's there waiting for us, and we're just playing. We're just the tardy hooky player, so we don't have to wait around for anybody else. We just have to remember that everybody else is already there, and then we discover that so are we.
Yes, they don't know they're there either, though.
Yeah.
So it's not like, you know, they're all, everybody else is holding it secret. They just don't know.
Yeah. What one more thing about that. Third to last paragraph, we're talking about if Yogananda works better for you. One example that came to mind is my dear friend, Mike Lemieux, who is an avid scholar, if you will, of Gary Renard's works. So, you know, for him, Artin and Persa are the symbols that work great for him. He doesn't read the Course much. I think he picks it up once in a while.
He's never read the Course, as far as I know.
Yeah. Well, he has, because he's been to the study groups that I was in Southern Oregon for several years, and so he's read, you know, at least some of it. I know, but because he was in the room with me on multiple occasions. But in terms of his daily spiritual practice, that for him involves, you know, studying the work of Artna Persa, which is not such a shabby approach, you know. I mean, if you're gonna pick, you know, some teachers, that's some pretty potent stuff there. So you know, whatever works for everyone. We all have different paths, and by all means, you know, as it says, you know, seek the truth. And you're going to find it, and exactly. And we're going to find it in everything and everyone, and that's ultimately where we get ourselves home, and is by, you know, dropping the exclusionary principle of one or the other that the ego represents, and then picking up the hand, taking the hand metaphorically of our inner kindness teacher, whatever symbol works for us, as this FAQ suggests, and discover that we never left. We're all you know, walking each other home.
Yep.
As Ram Dass says.
and we are entertaining each other along the way.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's there's nothing wrong with any of it.
Exactly. Now,
that's the thing that we have to really understand. There's nothing wrong with any of it. You know, people get upset when they say, you know, the world is made as an attack on God. Oh, this is terrible and the world must be bad. No, it's not bad. You know, just because, you know, there, you know, some stupid thought came into, you know, the mind of the Son of God doesn't mean that, you know, everything has been turned upside down. It just means that there was a stupid thought, and now we're seeing it is the answer to a question. It is absolutely, if you lived in, like Siddhartha, lived in a palace, lived with luxury, had no troubles, didn't know what illness was, didn't know what death was completely shielded from those things. And then he saw a sick person. And then he went and explored and found that there was sickness and death and that there was suffering in the world. And, you know, no, he recognized that all the suffering there, you know, somehow or the other, he could do something about. But the suffering, he still was home in heaven. Mm-hmm. He had a question. What if this paradise wasn't all? What if there was something outside of paradise? And he went and looked, and it was from his own mind that he saw sickness, suffering, death, sin. He saw those things. And because he saw those things, that became his world. It all became because we asked a question. He could have just as easily said, that's not my world. That can't be true, and go back to his life in the palace. Now, you know, in the real world, that would have ended in sickness, suffering, and death too. But, but in the symbolic world, you don't have to go there. You don't have to go there. Those people that seem to be living in suffering, they're in the palace too.
Mm-hmm.
They've never left their source.
Right, right. But we have this massive dream that there's this sandbox and all these little kids playing in it with paper swords, and we make such a big deal out of that sandbox drama that, you know, which is really a dream. You know, a theatrical production, and we've identified with these little kids, you know, playing in the sandbox with their toys, that we've forgotten. It's like, well, that's not our real identity here. Yeah.
Yep,
not at all.
Yep. So, well, cool. Well, thank you so much, Bruce.
Thank you, Lynn.
You'll be with us tonight to talk about the Weekend of Freedom Retreat.
Uh-huh. That's like 5 o'clock Pacific, is it?
Yep.
Okay. I got it on my calendar.
I will call you, and anybody else that Cheryl wants to call, because we can, you know, easily, well, Lori Coburn, I think I'll probably have to do that with her too.
Okay.
I can hold up to, I think, 9 people on a conference call on Skype.
Great.
So we will hear you. We will see you and hear you.
And then tomorrow night at 6 Pacific, right? And then 9 Eastern?
Tomorrow night at 9 Eastern.
Uh-huh.
Cheryl's talking about GIST and the Veil of Oblivion, the
Double Shields of Oblivion.
Shield of Oblivion.
Yeah.
So, all right, Bruce. I love you, brother.
Likewise, and to all.
All right.
Thanks.
Thank you.